there's something that happens that's a disturbing life event that we start putting up layers around ourselves to protect us and those around me. And when that control bubble grows and grows, it will explode us. The only thing I can do to lessen my control bubble is control myself, accept what I can't change, and be grateful.
Welcome to another episode of Relentlessly Resilient, presented by Minky Couture, where real people share real life experiences and the tools they develop to move forward and live their best life. I'm Michelle Scharf.
And I'm Jenny Taylor, and we're back in studio another day. Thanks to our good friends at Minky, we hope you've checked them out. There are 6 stores across Utah that you can go in. An outlet store in Ogden, I will tell you, I was there the other day. Such great prices. Yeah. But if you're not local or you just don't want to drive anywhere, you can also find them at MinkyCouture.com.
Amazing colors and designs. They've got everything
seasonal,
for
everything
everyone in
you
your
need.
Life. Yep. Who doesn't love a cozy blanket?
All right. It's going to be a great day today. We are here with a returning guest, Jeffrey Denning. Jeffrey J. Denning. Did I get that correct?
Well, yeah, sure.
He was one of our early guests. Like, we've got to think back to the beginning before we had Kellyanne Halverson as our producer, before we were allowed to be in studio. It's been a while. And so we're grateful, Jeff, that you'd come back
with
us. So
excited. Yeah.
Introduce us to our listeners that maybe didn't hear that first episode. Tell us what you do and have done professionally and what you are doing now.
So I'm a military veteran. I served in Iraq. I wrote a book actually in 2014, maybe. I interviewed in the book, Warrior SOS, my first book. I interviewed a handful of people from various military backgrounds, including 3 guys from Delta Force. So if you don't know that organization, is the creme de la creme of special operations, and they don't usually talk or go public. So it was kind of unique for 3 of them to be interviewed in my book, and the first guy from the unit to go public with his post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. I have a military and law enforcement background, law enforcement as well. I retired from Salt Lake City Police Department about 3 years ago. I was a negotiator. I was a detective, you know, SWAT team guy, and a bunch of tactical experience. I have a bunch of experience that way, but I also was in charge of or helped with training and in the unit full-time with crisis intervention training. So that's helping people with severe and persistent mental struggles, which unfortunately happens a lot. And now I work with First Responders First, a Utah-based mental health company providing therapy. I'm a therapist now. That was my 2nd master's degree. I'm a therapist doing counseling for first responders and their families.
And you said it's called First Responders First?
Yes, frfirstspelledout.com is the website, yeah.
Oh, I like that. I haven't heard of that. All right, so let's jump in. You mentioned a lot of things.
Yeah.
Military, law enforcement, mental health space, crisis intervention, negotiation. Where do we start?
Well, one of the things that's been on my mind a lot is suicide. Mm-hmm. Frankly, and actually it's coming up on the 3-year mark of my little brother's taking his life. And interestingly, I've gone around the state and into other states talking about how we can help each other and those facing and experiencing crisis, a lot to first responders, but I also speak to multiple other groups, and talking about suicide, talking about suicide intervention, talking about wellness and talking about trauma brain. So yes, suicide's kind of been on the mind. I've been teaching a bunch of different classes in a bunch of different locations lately, specifically about that. And I think one of the things is, I think there's a lot more struggles than you and I know. I know somebody who stepped on an explosive device in Afghanistan. He lost both of his legs and his good arm. And we can see when somebody is physically injured, but we cannot see the emotional amputations that are among people all around us.
Right.
We just can't see
them. Right. I mean, on some level.
On some degree or another, because we're human, so we have emotions.
Right.
And one of the things that happens, I think, is when we go through a crisis, mm-hmm. or a problem or troubles, it's like a giant magnifying glass that's above our head. And it just magnifies the negative emotions. And sometimes when we're not comfortable with the magnified negative emotions, mm-hmm. we think, man, I'm not normal. Something's really wrong with me. I have a problem. And we might not want to talk about it. We withdraw, we isolate, we might feel more sad than usual. We might feel to the point where, hey, nobody understands me and I'm all alone, so maybe I just need to check out. Or mm-hmm. what sometimes can happen is negative coping behaviors. So, you know, you add on substance abuse on top of that. Over 50% of the people who have attempted suicide are, and I don't know about the completed, I know some statistics specifically for law enforcement and firefighters, but over 50% of adults who have suicide ideation or suicide attempts have substance abuse issues. And over 70% of youth, kids and young kids. I say kids because, you know, I'm bald and I'm wearing glasses. So I just...
Everybody's a kid.
Right now. And so you say, well, what are they doing? They're trying to escape from the pain. And there's a lot of different ways we escape from the pain. But if you have, you know, what Dr. Walter Cannon said, is like you have a fight and flight attack. You have something where you're dealing with some kind of disturbing event that happens to you. We can call it trauma. I think trauma is used a lot. But you have a disturbing event or multiple events. And now what happens, you want to escape. You want to escape and avoid. And escaping and avoiding to negative coping behaviors can cause massive problems, and which can lead to suicide, sadly.
Right. I've had a lot of friends that have taken their life, and not all of them, but some of them involved relying on substances, mostly alcohol, which I think is the worst substance that you could possibly take. I mean, there's a lot better ones than alcohol, but that one seems to be one that some of my friends have taken their life, have used. It just is so freely available, and it's ironic because they're depressed, and alcohol depresses you.
Yeah.
But it does numb you for a little bit, and I can relate to that. When my husband died, I've shared this on this podcast before. I was drinking, and the first 4 months after he died was pretty dark. I was drinking to the point of being blacked out drunk every week, and I didn't drink during the week, but on the weekend I wasn't working. I was home by myself. I wanted to be checked out. I didn't want to be present. And I had shared this with a friend that I wasn't aware of was a recovered alcoholic. And he told me, he's like, you can feel this grief now, or you can feel it later with all of the grief that you've added on top of it. And I'm really concerned about what you're doing with this drinking, and you should consider not.
Right.
And that was a wake up call to me. And luckily, because I had never really had I didn't really even understand that there were serving amounts. Like, I just was ignorant to alcohol and how it impacts our body. And I started going to AA meetings just to make sure that I wasn't an alcoholic, or find out if I was, really. And I went through that program for a year, and I learned a lot about addiction. I also learned, you know, that alcohol is kind of insidious. Actually, it's kind of interesting that prohibition didn't work out so well, but it really leads to harming people in darker ways.
Yeah, big time. Well, here's one of the statistics.
It can be used healthy if somebody can drink a little at a time or whatever, or if they're not using it to cope. But
after trauma or after bad things happen, we need to not drink.
Yeah.
That's the key. And I actually learned that from Jeff Mitchell out of the University of Maryland, who works with first responders specifically after trauma. So one of the other things is I am on the state's critical incident stress management team, that we lead debriefings for first responders and ER staff, emergency department staff, all over the state after critical incidents. So basically, like, when there's a crisis and a challenge and a disturbing event that rises above the norm for first responders, which the norm is pretty low baseline. It's all, you know, tough stuff. But then they call us. And I'm the immediate past chair right now. So how do we help our first responders? Well, one of the statistics I found is 90% of police officers and firefighters who take their life by suicide have alcohol on board. In fact, police officers...
90%.
90%.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't surprise me, because you kind of get numbed out, right? It takes you out of your right mind.
Well, and that's exactly why you turn to something that says, you know what? I'm depressed. I don't feel good. Let me do something that makes me feel good. And so the alcohol's effect on the brain and the body, though, it makes you feel good for a second, but then it's a depressant, and it's a mood destabilizer. So when bad things happen, we actually need to not drink, because our brains, if we get good sleep, we get into REM. Mm-hmm. Our eyes go back and forth bilaterally. Okay, so we have this bilateral stimulation to both halves of our brain or our body, and that occurs during REM sleep, and it can occur, you know, when we're walking because it's bilateral stimulation, and it allows us to process in our brains the stuff that's happening, and so sometimes, you know, nightmares or night terrors or stuff like that come because our brain just didn't make sense. But if we're drinking because we can't go to sleep, or we're drinking to just make us sleepy, it's not allowing us to get good sleep. It's not allowing us to replenish. In fact, after this, I'm actually speaking with somebody who has been struggling with suicide ideation. And that person is not sleeping well at all. So one of the biggest things that causes more problems is the difficulty in sleeping.
Yeah, right.
It's an interesting conundrum, though. It's like
the sleep deprivation leads to more of that, the stress and the difficulty sleeping, which is exacerbated by the fact that you can't sleep.
Well said.
Yeah. I mean, honestly,
it's crazy. It's a horrible cycle.
So here's
which we've all experienced, I'm sure.
I know we're not focusing today solely on addiction, but Michelle, you mentioned a program like Alcoholics Anonymous or something like that. You're a counselor. You're working with people in a professional setting. Let's talk a little bit about addiction. If someone, we've looked at alcohol today as a mask, right, or a Band-Aid. We're not looking at it as a social drink. We're looking at it as something to cope, to take away, to numb, to lessen. How does someone who wants to get out of that, what steps can be taken? Because those addictions can be so deep and run so strong in the physiology, in the blood of the system. How do you help someone overcome that type of addiction that can be complicating their mental health, that can be making it so they can't sleep at night? They're so tired, they think the only thing they can do is drink. How do you counsel with someone to help them? I imagine in your work with suicide prevention and things, you face addiction and people with those struggles. Any pointers of resilience, particularly for our audience who might be listening that either struggle with that or probably know someone who struggles with that?
Yeah, well, I think the underlying reason is, why are they drinking in the first place? Mm-hmm. And so if we can say, what is it, what's the reason they wanted to escape in the first place? So again, we have magnified negative emotions. We got to sit with our emotions. So we had a difficulty or a difficult experience or trauma in the past. We've got to visit that. But the thing is, we want to avoid an escape. So one of the highest risks, there's different categories in the demographics of risk categories. And those with high ACEs scores, that's adverse childhood experiences. Okay, it's a 10 questions. And those with high ACEs scores are at elevated risk for substance use, for suicide, for all kinds of problems. So we need to first take a look at it and say, hey, what can we do to strengthen and help the resiliency in families so they can help kids? Mm-hmm. What can we do as a society, in our community, in our own homes, to help little kids? Because little kids grow up and they're adults. Okay. And here's what happens. Sometimes as youth, we experiment or look into drugs or alcohol or whatever. But what happens is those youth who get into drugs or alcohol and they're addicted, technically, for years maybe, if they try to get sober, it's like they've missed experiencing all the hard things during those growth periods.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it way harder for them.
So what can they do? I mean, I'm thinking,
what can they do? Go ahead. You tell me.
Right. No. I mean, we all know someone who you can easily say, adverse childhood experiences. I'll admit I have a love-hate relationship with this concept because I hate thinking that things that happened to or in my life by the time I was 10 or 15 are now going to dictate the rest of my life. Like, sure. I hate that. And yet it's very undeniable when you see people who've been through very difficult things by age 10 or 15 and the struggles they face, particularly if they haven't faced them but avoided them through substances or other addictions. And so I'm just looking, and we talk about resilience. What does resilience look like to you in that setting? What is resilience in the home or family setting to help children be more resilient? Because every adult in the world would love to take hardship away from all children, and that's just not reality.
And
so how do
helpful.
We help? How do you define resilience, and how do we teach it?
Well, that's a good question. One, I think the first part of your question from earlier is like, we've got to deal with the trauma. And how do you deal with the trauma? In part, you need to say, what is my purpose? When I have a difficult thing that happens to me, I'm kind of helpless of the outcome. If I have a specific hope, if I have a specific expectation and the reality is negative toward my expectation, if I'm in a marriage and my marriage isn't the way I expect it, if I'm all of a sudden a widow and I wasn't expecting that, if now I'm looking back at my life and saying, I didn't expect life to be like this. Sometimes, though, the obstacle becomes the way, like the Stoic says.
Mm-hmm.
So I say now it affects our belief system. It affects our worldview, meaning trauma. Trauma does that. It affects our worldview. And that affects our belief system. When it affects our belief system, it affects us at the core. It affects our purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So what's our new purpose? What's our identity? And trying to get kids to understand these things, not just kids, but adults. What's my identity and what's my purpose? Because I can label myself and say, well, okay, I have post-traumatic stress disorder. Or I can label myself as maybe a kid in high school. Okay, I'm a jock. Or I could say, okay, I'm a cheerleader. Or I could say, okay, I'm a Texan. Or I could say, okay, I'm a cop. And all those are superficial labels. What am I really at my core? What is my identity? Once I can discover my true identity, then I can discover my purpose and my worth. Because what happens is we don't know, and the trauma brain kicks in, and then we will start doing things that will give us feelings just the opposite of hopelessness, but it's what's called false pro or false protection. So in rock climbing, if you place an anchor in the wall that's not good, it's false pro, false protection.
Mm-hmm.
And there are false pros. It's like alcohol is a false pro. Sex can be a false pro. Now, sex can be a unifying thing too, but affairs and pornography and hookups and swinging and open relationships and prostitution, it's you look at this and wonder, why are people doing this? Because they want to feel alive.
Mm-hmm.
We want to have a sense of belonging. We want to have acceptance. But you look at these kids and they're like, they're joining gangs. Why? Because of that. But
right.
It's false pro.
It's a false sense of connection. My son used to say, we were struggling, and this was even before my husband died, but there was already trauma in the house because my husband was going to die and we knew that. And he would say, well, I have my bros, I have my friends, he wasn't in a gang, but, you know, his friend group, you know, which were, you know, a bunch of kids that were acting like hoodlums. And I'd say, those kids are not there for you. Your family's here for you. And you've got some things you need to work on. And he just had the hardest time with that concept until something really bad happened to him. And those guys were not there for him. But who was? His mom, his siblings. And it's like, those are hard lessons to learn, and they're painful, but they think that they can have whatever avoidance they're getting out of that and have those relationships with these connections that are not real. And so it's like a false sense of connection. It's a false sense. And I'm getting to be my rebellious self and do the things that I want. And it feels like you're in control, but actually you're completely out of control.
Sure.
It's the entire thing is a lie.
I wonder, you know, sometimes what happens is when we're a little bit discombobulated, we want to do something that makes us feel alive. So we might seek for those things that make us feel alive. It seeks for those things that give us hits of dopamine.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be, you know, it could be social media scrolling, but we know by the science says it's not healthy. Now, I've seen other people writing pro-social media, people write in peer-reviewed journals saying, well, no, it is. It's good. It has a sense of connection. But,
no,
you know, 30...
it doesn't.
Empty scrolling kind.
No.
I have to tell you, when I lost my husband, my dad said to me, I wish there was more than I can do, but I see that you had like 250
people liking your post when John died. So I know that you have the support that you need. I had zero commentary for that.
Wow.
I was like,
yeah.
What I need is people that are actually not on social media that are walking up and knocking on my door.
That are up in my space.
I need somebody to come and sit with me and just witness my grief. And those
really
were few.
Be there.
Those were few. Because we live in this world where everyone thinks, well, I liked your post, or I sent you my condolences, or I said a prayer. Those are just
enough.
Words often.
Sure. Well, on that note, somebody who might be struggling, we need people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, often if we're sad, if we're depressed, then we withdraw and we isolate and we start telling ourselves, well, I'm the problem. In fact, often people who take their life by suicide, from the many suicides I've investigated, completed suicides, or the letters that I've read, including my little brothers, right? Mm-hmm. It says, I'm the problem, and people will be better off without me.
They really believe that.
They really do, and it's a skewed sense of belief. But here's the thing, is often those people who are alive or witness that, we say, well, it's selfish of them to do that, because can't they see everybody's crying? Well, it's a skewed sense of thought, and they think they're the problem, so we shouldn't judge them. I got to say this, of all the literally hundreds and hundreds of people I've talked to who are suicidal, literally hundreds,
mm-hmm.
we just need to not judge them. We need to understand, one, they still have the choice up to their very last second what they decide to do.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to understand that. We need to understand that they're probably not in their right frame of mind. If they were in their normal, healthy frame of mind, then they wouldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And they think those thoughts that I just mentioned, that they're the problem, that other people would be better off without them, which is never the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they're telling themselves that, and they just happen to believe it. They also think that, I believe that people don't take their life because they want to see what happens after the life, or they just don't believe, and so they just take their life. They take their life because they're in such pain, they just want the pain to go away. So people aren't killing themselves just to kill themselves. They want the pain to go away. So over 20 years ago, on a Tuesday morning, hundreds of people walked into the World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm.
They walked up the World Trade Center, and when the heat from the fire got too much and there was an escape, the mm-hmm. windows were open, dozens of people jumped to their death.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want the heat.
Right.
So to me, I look at suicide a little bit differently and say, man, I can have compassion on somebody who I don't understand fully. And maybe there are listeners who do understand that. Maybe there are people who've attempted suicide themselves and say, okay, I get it. But maybe we do not fully understand what everybody's been through.
Yeah.
We just don't.
It's interesting that you brought up that analogy. My husband used that analogy when he was working. We were being interviewed by BYU for the right to end life. We were LDS at the time, very active. But he wanted the right to end his life. He had prostate cancer and metastasized. The doctors were telling him it's a horrifically painful way to die. Very hard to manage pain. And he wanted to be in control of that. And he actually used that analogy. And he's like, I get why those people jumped out. They wanted to be able to be the ones to have some layer of control, some sense that they were the ones ending their lives and not this horrific fire that was thrust upon them. And so in his mind, that's how he read that. Like, he's like, don't you want? And I just wonder if it's some level the same way when people take that choice to take their life into their own hands, that they're like, I don't see any other option, but this option, I know I can take it and I can end this pain for sure. It's done. Because oftentimes people don't, it's not like, it just pops into their head and they're like, I have an idea. I'm going to end my life today.
Right. And
it doesn't
somebody,
work that way. It's years of pain usually, right? Or months.
No,
maybe.
Not necessarily. It could be immediate, just like in the World Trade Center.
Okay.
All of a sudden, something bad happens and they don't see a way
but
out.
There is a trigger.
Yeah, obviously. And it's not the event that happens to us. It's what we think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So there can be situations. I've dealt with people in such situations that says, I am in crisis right now. And at one person, I said, hey, let's take your guns and give them to a friend. And that person let me know about it 2 days later. Thanks. I was going to walk upstairs and kill myself after you left. So that was a crisis of immediacy. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that can happen. Now, there can be years and years of pain, years and years of suicide ideation. But let me just bring up what you had mentioned about, you know, maybe the right to end your life, mm-hmm. that euthanasia. There's a story, and because you brought mm-hmm. it up, I'm going to mm-hmm. say it, okay? Mm-hmm. There's a story of a man who lost his dad in battle, and he lost all his kinship and all his friends. He had no friends, no mm-hmm. nor whither to go, he says. And he said, how long the Lord will suffer mm-hmm. that I shall remain? I don't know.
Right.
And that's at the end of the Book of Mormon. Mm-hmm. So, and was he suffering? You bet. Mm-hmm. But I still think if we can just say, hey, you know what? On the Lord's time. But wait a minute. My father-in-law had dementia and he was just not in a good spot. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to watch that, to mm-hmm. suffering. But sometimes we just say, hey, let's just wait. Because if we have a belief in the life after this, then we can say, okay, I'm going to have a belief and trust in things that I cannot control. Just like the Serenity Prayer. We can't control anyone, so I need to accept the things I cannot control. We can't control people. Mm-hmm. We can't control circumstances. We can't control situations. So earlier when I was saying, hey, here's our expectation, and reality is always deviated mm-hmm. from expectation, and it causes distress and grief and pain and loss. But if I want to narrow that deviation to have less loss, less grief, less pain, then I need to accept the things I can't control. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? I can accept the way my kids are acting if, yep. What about my boss? Yep. Because when trauma occurs, we put layers around ourselves to control more mm-hmm. because our worldview spins change to affect our belief system. And the world we view now is not safe. We might think differently of ourselves, of others, and the whole world, which again, it affects our spirituality at the core. Even not if it's a specific religion, but the core mm-hmm. of our belief system.
Mm-hmm.
And it does, which could
absolutely.
Be existential. And when it does, we put these layers up around ourselves. The more layers we put up around ourselves is to protect ourselves from being wounded. And when that happens, our control bubble grows and it starts to affect everyone around us. And when it affects everyone around us, somebody's pushing on my control bubble. Well, why? Let me just give you an example. So law enforcement background, okay. My daughter say, hey, I want to go over to so-and-so's house. Well, no, I don't know their parents. And I said, who said you could go over there? Mom said, no, I want to go to a movie theater such party with this birthday party with a bunch of kids. And they're just 13, 14-year-old. Who said you could go, Mom? So now Mom, is my wife, is mm-hmm. pushing on my control bubble. Mm-hmm. And my kids are. Because what is my belief system? I'm like, hey, I've investigated child sexual assaults in the bathrooms of
movie theaters,
mm-hmm. or the kids say, I want to go over to so-and-so's house. No, because everything I've been exposed to has been negative.
Right.
But I've seen a lot of bad things. And so I'm like, if I don't know them, the world's not safe. So I look at things a little differently. I want more control mm-hmm. so that I don't get hurt and that people around me don't get hurt.
Right.
And we can do that on a different level from everyone in this room. Mm-hmm. There's something that happens that's a disturbing life event that we start putting up layers around ourselves to protect us and those around me. And when that control bubble grows and grows, it will explode us. So the only thing that we have control over is ourselves. We have control over what we think, what we do, what we say, what we believe. Mm-hmm. And we need to look internally. So, Jenny, you were asking me, okay, how does somebody overcome addiction? This is one of the main ways. You need to say, hey, I've had bad things happen to me where I didn't have control of the outcome and it was disturbing, but I have to control me. The only thing I can do to lessen my control bubble, because the bigger the bubble gets, it's going to pop, mm-hmm. is control myself, accept what I can't change, and be grateful. Gratitude will change you. I was just talking to someone, a dear friend of mine, who 2 years ago lost his wife on Valentine's Day to suicide. And he, just while we were talking earlier, visiting his friends, he had tears in his eyes when he was talking about gratitude. And he said, you know, Jeff, I used to think that when end of life comes or when you know, whether you call it a rapture or the second coming, where the end of life comes. He says, I used to be really scared. And then my 10-year-old just said, Dad, my cousin said that when the end comes, that people who are dead are going to come back alive again. And he had tears in his eyes when he was saying that. People who take their life by suicide don't have hope. That's one of the reasons why we know scientifically, and I can point it out, Tedeschi or Connor and Davidson have specifically said spirituality is a pillar for wellness and will help us. We need spiritual wellness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting in our culture today, what our parents or grandparents or their parents did, they were reading the Bible, their Christian beliefs, they were looking for hope. And as hope wanes, I think there's a correlation with spirituality. Maybe you could call it religiosity. But as spirituality wanes, then we think, well, what's the purpose anyway? If there's a lack of hope, then why not just die? So we begin to get in our heads and think, what's it all about anyway? That affects the core of our identity. And yes, I'm with you, Jenny. Like, whatever happened to somebody as a kid, we don't need to say, I need to use that as a crutch for my whole life in adulthood. But the science is there that it does affect the way we see ourselves, the way we see others, and the way we see the world. So part of it is, what do we need to see? Our eyes need to be open to understand, hey, how can I be well? And in order to achieve balance and health and wellness, one of the key elements is to say, I need to live up to the things I value most. And looking at the things you value most, you need to look internally and say, well, what is it all about? I'll just tell you, after I came back from Iraq, I was not doing well. I knew for months that I wasn't doing well. And I'm like, I probably need to get help. And I have six kids and three girls at the time. I was kind of yelling at them at night. Hurry up and get to bed. The loud noise and just, I was irritated. And we know that anger is a secondary emotion. There's something else going on there. And I found myself yelling at my little girls. That was against the core value that I believed, to be kind, especially little kids. I had a little breakout and wiped a tear away that was welling up in my eye. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to go get help. Because if I'm the problem, the acceptance portion that I'm talking about isn't just to say, okay, accept everybody. But in part is, if you're having problem in your relationship, if you're having problem with your boss, if you're having problem at all, if you're struggling, guess what? It's not anybody else's fault. It's you.
Right. Most people don't take the time for that self-awareness piece, and we're not taught it.
No. Wouldn't it be great if in high schools and junior highs that we were taught these basic
elements? Yeah, we just did an entire hour to put out on self-awareness because we're not taught that.
No.
And actually, churches don't really teach it either. And also, their focus is to be in service, be in service, be in service. But it's not necessarily about really reflecting on who you are as an individual. That piece somehow gets missed. I was raised missionary Baptist, and we were told to think of ourselves as selfish. And I've learned I had to put away that belief and realize unless I take time for myself, I can't be selfless.
I am so glad you brought that up, Michelle. When I go teach classes, that's one of the biggest things I say. You would drop everything right now to go help somebody you love. You would totally bend over backwards. Well, why aren't we doing it now?
Because we neglect ourselves. We've been taught systematically to neglect our own needs because everybody else's needs, especially as women, everybody else's needs take priority. Our spouse, our children, our grandchildren, our aunts, our uncle, whoever, our cousins, anyone that is asking anything of a woman in this society. Her raising, her rearing has been,
it is your job to nurture and give.
Yeah, but self-care is not selfish, because right. if you aren't well, how can you help anybody else? Just like when
but
I was an air marshal. When I was an air marshal, you know how many times I heard the flight attendant say, if the oxygen mask drops, who do you put it on first? You've got to do it to yourself.
Right, but, they tell you that because the reason they say that every time is because the women on a plane would take
that mask. Default to putting on the child.
And would be 100%. Helping their child before they ever got their own mask
100%.
On.
I mean, you look at any time somebody falls through the ice, sometimes somebody will go in there at the risk of their own peril, and sometimes it's not good. And people will risk to help each other. That's why you had first responders running into the World Trade Center to help people. And it's normal to help people. We need to have the proper equipment to help ourselves, which is the part of resiliency. Mm-hmm. So Archbishop Desmond Tutu said something like this, I'm paraphrase, we need to go upstream and figure out what's causing people to jump in.
Yeah.
That's the key. So if we're talking about suicide awareness and prevention, yes, I can say, hey, if somebody's struggling, I need to ask, are you going to kill yourself? You're going to take your life by suicide? That's not going to cause somebody to do it. We too often don't ask friends or coworkers or anybody else because we're afraid of the answer, but we need it's us. Remember, that's the problem. We don't need to be afraid of that. If we're the one uncomfortable, are you kidding me? Be uncomfortable with uncomfortable situations. But part of wellness, part of prevention is wellness. So what are we doing for our wellness? I'll tell you, we need sleep. We are not focusing enough on sleep. Too much light and not enough sleep. Way too much. And I will tell you that a Harvard psychologist said this, look, my clients, if they're high anxiety, meaning worry and fear, okay, high anxiety, high depression, he said, in order to get them back on their baseline, he said, I need them to wake up every time at the same time. Our anxiety levels, our depression levels, and our wellness are properly tied with circadian rhythms. And then he said, one of the first things I do is in the morning, if they're suffering or if you're suffering, eat a high fat, high protein breakfast, no carbs, no sugars, because if something stressful is happening later in the day, you'll mop up all your blood sugar. You become hypoglycemic and psychophysiologically unstable all day. And it will not go back to normal until you fast all night through sleep.
Right.
So what do we do in our modern society?
We don't really realize that these things are all connected to each other.
100%. Our body, our nutrition.
Our sleep cycle regulates the reset factory in our body, and that our nutrition is impacted by that as well.
So
it all layers in.
100%. So here's what our society has done, okay? We've all of a sudden got the incandescent light bulb, and now we have LEDs, and now we have blue lights. And now we're staying up really late, and now we have internet, so and parents are giving their kids phones, and we wonder why kids are not doing well. Okay.
Yeah.
They're giving them phones and TVs in their rooms, and they're staying up late. And then they wake up in the morning and they're eating the bowl full of cereal that's full of sugar. And so
unregulated children to school to be picked
everywhere.
Up by their bullies.
Well, so here's what's happened. If we could just back in the day, it's like, okay, you wake up when the rooster crows and you go to bed and you turn the light out and you go out and work, you walk. You actually do some labor. We need physical movement.
Mm-hmm.
If we had deliberate movement, we would be more healthy. Our bodies keep the score. That's the name of a book by Bessel van der Kolk about trauma. Our bodies truly keep the score. So if we could just exercise or move, there's a study that says that if we do it 30 minutes a day for 6 days a week, it's as good or better than SSRIs, which are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors or pills for wellness.
Mm-hmm.
As good or better. So go walk to school. Go eat a high-fat, high-protein breakfast, okay? Go eat some eggs. Go eat some bacon. But sometimes we say, no, it's not good for us. It's too much cholesterol. I don't know that that's the case. But if you don't want to eat eggs or you don't want to eat sausage or something like that, then eat an avocado and eat some nuts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I eat half an avocado with an egg, so super high-fat. It's amazing.
It's good for our brains.
It is.
Okay, I'm loving all of this, and I'm sad that we're running out of time. I've written down a lot of things you shared, Jeff, but just a moment ago, you touched on sleep, nutrition, and movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, you know, what is resilience? How do we train resilience? How do we build resilience, whether in ourselves, whether in our homes and families, whether in our schools or workplaces? What a difference would it make if we as a society would focus on those three things rather than the latest quick fix, the latest medication, another drink at the bar, another, like you mentioned, sex addictions or things, any of those that are trying to get that feeling that hit, whether it's a drug or something else, how much of that could we resolve within ourselves if we went back to those super, super basics of get the right sleep, get proper nutrition, and move your body? So that's kind 100%. Of going to be my takeaway, particularly as a mom, because I'll admit, like, I'm raising kids who faced a decent chunk of trauma in their childhood, and I'm not naive enough to think that's going to be the only hard thing they'll ever face. We all know that, right? There's not one trial, and then you're done with trials. And I am slightly scared to death that my kids' childhood experience with losing their father or any other trauma that they face will become that defining moment that puts them on a very difficult path for the rest of their lives. And that breaks my heart. I know that's the last thing Brent would want. It's the last thing John would want. It's the last thing any of us would want. And I know I can't take away from my kids the difficulties they need to face. I can't take away the growth and the growing pains they'll need to go through on their own journey. But there are some really basic things we can do to help build that resilience, or at least give our children and ourselves as a community a better shot at resilience. So again, I wish we had hours and hours more, but Jeff, can you tell us, what is resilience to you? Can you put some parameters around it in your work, your real lived experience? You've got a wealth of personal pathways through either resilience or lack of resilience that you've experienced. Can you sum that up for us?
Yes, thank you. It's a good thing to reflect on. Let me add to those three things that you mentioned two more.
Please.
And one is people. We need people. The people, if we're kids, it's the people we choose to hang out with. If we're adults, again, it's the people we choose to hang out with and the people we choose to be that will help us and in some cases hinder us. Okay, we know that peer support done the wrong way, scientific studies have shown, that could be bad or negative. But we need people. We can't be stuck alone on a desert island with a beach
volleyball.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then the other thing is, and I mentioned earlier, is gratitude. Science by Emmons and McCullough. John Emmons is probably the foremost expert on gratitude. If you write down three things every day that you're grateful for, you will change the neural pathways of your mind to start looking for the good. So as first responders, I'm going around teaching them, like, look, you're constantly exposed to the negative things. Everybody's worst day, you're going to that. So how can you look for the good? If you want to be healthy, you need to focus on those five things. And then all underneath is, like I've really emphasized here, is I need to understand at the core who I really am. And we just so happened that we started to talk about some spirituality. That wasn't my intention, nor is it when I go out and do training. But I'll tell you, that is the foundational piece of our wellness. Who we are, and do we have a purpose? And if I can understand my macro purpose and my micro purpose, then that's going to make all the difference. What were you put here to do? If I can take some time to either meditate or prayer, which we know functional MRIs will change our brains for the better with prayer and meditation. There's a book by a neuroscientist called The God Who Changes Brains that he doesn't talk about religion. He just talks about what's happening neuroscientifically. That will change our brains. And so as we meditate and pray and try to understand what is going on, who am I, then I can understand in the quiet moments, you know what, I was sent here to write a book. I was sent here to do a podcast with other people like you two. I was sent here to sing a song. And by that creativity and by that purpose, when we face the obstacle becomes the way. That's when we can have growth. We can call it post-traumatic growth, but truly growth, because we know who we are. And if we have a purpose and an identity, then we can have a direction and a drive. That's what resilience is to me.
That's incredible. That's awesome. Well, I really appreciate you coming and talking to us about this today. Like we said before we started this podcast, there's a lot of different subjects that we could cover with you because you have a wealth of experiences underneath your belt and the time that you've walked this planet. So thank you for coming and sharing with us. And
thanks for the five tips and just the stories. I think there's a lot for us to reflect on. It goes very well with the episode we recently recorded on mindfulness and being self-aware. Mm-hmm. And I think those can be, if you haven't heard that episode yet, go back and listen to that. You'll want to hear some of the things Michelle shared. She's a trained personal life coach and gave some great pointers along with what you've shared, Jeff. And I think there's just a lot in our society today that wants us to just hurry and rush through. And both of you, these lessons you've taught have been telling us to basically just slow down for a minute, take a minute, take a moment. And so hopefully everyone will take a chance to do that. We're always grateful to our listeners. Thanks for tuning in. Wherever you find us, whichever podcast platform, we invite you to please go back and give us a like, a rating, and a review. It actually helps us get the word out about the podcast to other listeners, and it helps us know how we might be able to improve the show. We're also always looking for people to help us learn tools of resilience through their shared life experiences. So if you have a life story or something that you've been through that's helped you that you're willing to share, please reach out to us. You can find us on Facebook at Relentlessly Resilient or Instagram at Relentlessly Resilient Podcast. And on either one of those, there's a little button you can click on that'll help you connect with Michelle so you can talk with her offline for a minute about what you've been through and what you've learned and what you might be able to share here with our listeners on the show. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Thanks to our producer, Kellyanne Halverson, in studio for making everything sound great. And thanks to Minky for being our presenting sponsor and keeping us all warm and cozy, regardless of the weather outside.
Absolutely. We really appreciate Minky Couture. Remember, whatever you do today, remember to be kind. You have no idea the struggles others are dealing with in their lives. Have a great day.